So I picked up on the lead from my colleague Bert Brody, who taught a course called Light and Color, which was actually a required part of the photography major. So students had to take a course in the physics of light as part of their major in physics. And I thought, well, the art that I know the best is music, so why don't I develop a course on sound and on music? But in this, I am entirely self-taught. I never took a course on acoustics. I actually am a experimental nuclear physicist by trade. I work at Atom Smashers, you know, but physicists have the arrogance to think they can figure out anything. And who in the room could contradict me if I put something forward? So, you know, a few people here are taking or have taken the class, so they know this is true. But I teach this acoustics course at least once a year. Marianne, you can testify that it's a very popular course, yes, very highly regarded. So I teach, I've expanded it to take in 40 or 45 students at every time I teach it, with smaller labs, so I'm working with them one-on-one. But every time I teach it, I have more than twice as many people requesting it. So it's a course that students come in thinking, oh, I'm interested in music, I'm interested in sound. They don't know that I'm sneakily teaching them physics all along the way. So the question I would like to engage in here, there's another seat up here. The question I'd like to engage in is, why do things make the sounds they do? And I'm going to make that question more specific, but I'm going to get at it at first by talking about things that we know pretty well. So for instance, why does this make this sound, but when I put my finger down here, sorry, it's a very old beat-up guitar.
My action's a little high.
Yeah. Exactly, it's getting a little more.
Strings are a little high there.
Okay, why is it that when I put my finger down at that point, I get an octave higher? When I blow on this tube, I get an octave higher. When I take these two metal pipes, and yes, these are just bought from Williams Lumber down the hall, down the road, and cut into pieces with a little rubber washer there, and if I hit this one, I get something that's almost an octave. It's very close. Okay, so why do those different things give the sounds they do? Well, using these as an example, I will ask you for a little group participation here. So, low note, high note, this one, low note, high note. What do you notice? The longer one gives lower notes, right? And then you start thinking, oh yeah, yeah, no, the piccolo is this long, the flute is this long. The trumpet, if you don't bother unrolling, is about this long, whereas the trombone is lower notes and is about this long, and so on. So we have some sense that length is one of the factors that determines how something can, what kind of tone the thing is going to give. But then you notice this a little more carefully, and this is where you have to be physical and mathematical, is that you notice that the length ratios here are not the same thing. So this is where the physicist comes in, is to say not just, okay, longer things produce lower notes, but actually to try to figure out how they do that. And we do it mathematically by, in my class, as one of my students here can testify, you know, I stick them in the lab every week and we're investigating things, we're investigating them sonically and using instrumentation, some scientific instrumentation. And we also work out some of the simpler mathematical ways to approach what these things are. Okay? So I'm going to try to talk you through some of the very basic ideas. This is, without a joke, sort of a 30 or 40 minute version of half of a semester of my course. Then you're probably thinking, oh great, I could have just come to this one class and show up every day for all the time you did. Okay, so sound is a vibration. We'll talk just about the air, of course we can go through other media, but sound is a vibration. So what's happening is my vocal cords are vibrating the sound and resonates in my mouth and throat. But eventually what happens, whether it's me speaking to you or the sound coming out of this tube, what's happening is the air at the end here ends up vibrating and causing a compression wave which travels through the air. Eventually that air reaches your eardrum and this wave of transmission makes some things vibrate up against your ear. That's what starts the process of this membrane flexing, which stimulates the middle ear bones, which then gets into the inner ear, where we perceive these vibrations and turn them into information of some kind. Now, one of the things that you can thank the physicists and Mr. Fourier in particular for figuring out is that all of these rich, complicated vibrations that we can talk about can actually be decomposed into a sum, usually an infinite sum, but a sum nonetheless of simple oscillations, oscillations like this. So this is what we call simple harmonic motion, where something is just going up and down, okay? It's going up and down in a motion like this. And the two aspects I want you to focus on are the time and the size, okay? The size is what we call the amplitude. So if we think of this as the equilibrium, the amplitude is how far above and below that equilibrium position the oscillation goes. That's a large amplitude. This is a small amplitude, something just going up and down a little bit, okay? The frequency or the period has to do with the timing. So if I take these two different springs, there's a hypnosis aspect to this.
Yeah.
If I take these two different springs, you see that these two things have different periods, different oscillation timings. I'm going to use those words. They're not interchangeable. They're actually inverses of each other. By period, I mean how long one oscillation takes. And by frequency, I mean how many oscillations there are per unit time. So one of them is just the inverse of the other. You could say the sun comes up once a day, or you could say the period of the sun's motion is one day for a cycle. So one of them is just the inverse of the other one. So the terminology that's usually used, period, would always be measured in units of time. It might be seconds, milliseconds, whatever. Whereas cycles per second is what we call the hertz, the symbol HZ, named for Heinrich Hertz, the first guy to make electromagnetic waves that weren't just, that were actually constructed electronically. So we give him, that's when you've hit the big time in physics, when you get a unit named after you. My mother asked me once if I would hit the big time in physics, and I said to her, well, Mom, in mathematics we take ddx, ddy. She would get it, so. I tried to make her feel better about my success in the world. So if we were to graph out this motion, did everybody get the handout?
Mm-hmm.
If we were to graph out this motion in time, you can see the amplitude would be how far it goes up and down above there, and the timing would be how long it takes to go through that cycle. So this might be, for instance, the picture you get on an oscilloscope if you're looking at these oscillations. And if you had the oscilloscope sweeping across the screen a certain number of times per second, then a slow oscillation would only get a couple of cycles in there in time, whereas a fast oscillation would get a lot of cycles in that much time. So one of the things we do in the class is learn how to, apropos to the last discussion, students have got the very first lab we do, I've got an oscilloscope set up there, something that produces the oscillation and a speaker, and students learn to correlate what they're hearing with what they're seeing on the screen. So the sound gets louder and softer, and the picture on the screen gets bigger and smaller like this. The sound gets higher and lower in pitch, and the picture squeezes in and out like this. So I'm going to bring up a particular distinction there between the physics, and the experience. Now, yesterday in Jonathan's talk, the most complicated graphic he put up there was what's called the Fletcher-Munson curve, and that is actually a really nice example, because that curve, that was the one with lots of different curves on it showing what our hearing ranges are, that curve has on its axes two physics quantities, frequency, how many oscillations per second the sound is, and intensity of the sound, namely how high I turned up the dial on the machine that produces the sound. Those are both physics ideas. What those lines were on the graph were perceived loudness. So that line, one of those lines is, what they did is they said to everybody, okay, here's a sound at 1,000 hertz. Now here's another sound at 300 hertz, tune this one until it makes sounds as loud to you as the other one. Purely experiential. It is not, okay, you got it wrong because the physicist's dial is this. It's they're trying to draw a connection between what we hear and what sound is being produced electronically in this case, but the difference between experience and what's actually out there producing the thing is a lot of what that's about. And so we learn a lot about those things during the semester, but the primary thing I want to get across here is that amplitude, how big the oscillation is, that corresponds almost entirely to loudness. So if I push the air on your eardrum in and out a lot, you're going to have a larger electronic experience inside your brain, which we interpret as loudness. If I only push it in and out a little bit, that's going to be a quieter sound. Whereas the pitch, whether we think high notes, low notes, that's the frequency. And you actually know that yourself. If you put your hand on your own throat and you think about saying high notes and low notes, you can feel that the vibration is faster or slower. And it's slower in the low cases and it's faster in the high cases. And that idea, and I'm going to talk about pitch from here on in, that idea that low notes are slow oscillations and high notes are faster oscillations is why we might suspect, okay, we can actually learn why it is that this oscillation gives the kind of timing that it does. In other words, whatever's going on in the air in this tube, this one takes longer than this one because this one is longer. It's two different uses of the word long, one for time, one for distance. This one, and in fact, that's exactly what's going on. So what's going on in a tube like this, and I'll use Vitalis as a helper here. Okay. He's seen this demo enough times that he can sort of do it in his sleep at this point. So what's happening inside that tube is we actually get some sort of oscillation like this. Okay? So this oscillation, what our two relatively fixed hands would represent is the pressure at the end of each tube, or the extension of the string on the guitar. So the guitar string is tied down here, it's tied down there, and when you pluck it, this is what it does. It vibrates up and down like that. And it's that steady oscillation up and down at a fixed frequency that stimulates the air in a way that ends up giving you a particular pitch. Okay? Whereas if I shorten the string, you'll notice that the same oscillation actually goes faster. Okay? And when I shorten it, it has to go faster there as well. Now the reason is not at all obvious. What is actually happening, that's fine, what's actually happening there is he's a Bard student, unlike most of them, he's very passive, you know, he's just standing there holding the spring at his end, where I'm sending a pulse down there, which bounces off his hand, comes back to me, and I have to time it just right to reinforce that thing so that the constant back and forth of the two traveling waves reinforces each other and gives you this nice, simple standing wave here. Okay, if I tried it at any other frequency, I would see something like that. It would not be a standing wave, would not be something that is constantly being reinforced. So it actually is, the length actually determines what it is. The reason that this one gives a low note and this one gives a high note is the wave that I start by blowing on the end of this tube takes more time to come down here, bounce off this end, and come back than it would if the tube was only this long. It really is that simple. That when you take things like an air tube, or you take a guitar string, and this was something that Pythagoras figured out a few thousand years ago. He found that if you had a string like this, and you didn't change anything else on it, but you cut the string in half in distance, you got a note that was an octave higher. Being a mathematical philosopher, he extrapolated this to a universal principle that applied to everything, which it doesn't, you know. But he figured out, he was the one who said, oh, in fact, you can do that about all frequencies. You can find out that the things that we base most of our harmonies on, fifths, fourths, thirds, and so on, are particular ratios of frequencies. Pythagoras thought they were ratios of the thing itself, that somehow there was a threeness to this particular harmony, when actually he didn't really understand the physicality of it that it's a frequency of an oscillation that's going on. So we can actually try to figure out from that what it is that, you know, why it is we're getting these particular oscillations and why it is we get the frequencies that we do. I go back to these things here, and this is lab three, I think we did, where I had students working on these oscillations exactly of the spring. Now, clearly, these are not sound, but they are physical examples of the oscillation that we can actually study in a way, we can study in more than one way. You can watch it, you can tabulate things about it, but in particular, you can time it. You can time it with something that doesn't require the mental leap of, oh, this is what the oscilloscope is telling me. You time it with a stopwatch. So students can see that this spring here oscillates things at a different frequency than this does, and we systematically go through what that is. So what are the two things you notice about the springs that I carefully chose for my laboratory? Okay, this one here doesn't go down as far, right? This one here gets stretched a whole lot more, even though the two masses are the same. So this spring here is somehow stiffer. It's stronger. Okay, and this is one of the two principles that we have to keep track of. What we're talking about is oscillation around an equilibrium. So one of the factors to think about is what force is pushing or pulling it back to that equilibrium. That's what I call the restoring force. Okay? This one here is a stiffer spring. It has a stronger restoring force than this one. And so this one here actually ends up oscillating more slowly because this spring doesn't pull as hard as this spring does. And that's just, even without knowing Newton's laws, you know that when you push harder on something, it's going to move faster. And that's the basic idea of the restoring force. A higher restoring force is going to give you a higher frequency. It's going to give you shorter time oscillation. Whereas if I take that same spring, either one of the springs, like this, and you can get in mind what that oscillation looks like. Now I'm going to put both masses on there, and you notice that now the whole thing travels more slowly. It takes longer. Well, the spring is still the same, so that ain't it. What is it? Oh, well, you also know that if something gets bigger, it's harder to move, right? The way I say to my students, I say, okay, I could throw this tennis ball at you, or I could throw this desk at you, you know? Which one do I have to work harder to do, and which one is going to take more work on your part to bring it to a stop? And the answer is, bigger things are harder to move. That's what I call inertia. Inertia is not just how hard something is to move, it's how hard it is to change its motion in any way. How hard is it to speed it up? How hard is it to slow it down? And in particular for this case, how hard is it to turn it around? To first slow it down and then bring it back into place. So the fundamental idea of the first third of my course is every oscillation depends on these two factors. I'll talk about frequency. The frequency is a restoring term divided by an inertial term. So if the restoring term is higher, stronger, you have more restoring force, things are moving faster, you get higher frequencies. If there's more inertia, that's in the denominator. Down here, you make the denominator bigger, you make the frequency smaller. If you have more inertia, if something is bigger, harder to move, it's going to slow the thing down. Every oscillation is a tug of war between those two factors. Okay, I'm sure there's some Zen principle there about oppositions there, but we're talking about how hard something pulls and how hard that thing is to move in the first place. Now, that's even true for waves. So the waves that I was studying up here, put you up here again for a second. Okay, so the inertia factor is how heavy this spring is. If I had used a lighter one, it would be easier to move up and down. But the restoring factor is the tension in it. So I didn't change our distance, but now you see we get higher frequencies because I tightened the spring. Okay? So those principles are at the heart of everything we do with designing musical instruments. So take the string as an example. I can change the pitch by changing the restoring force. Less restoring force is going to give me a lower note. More restoring force gives me a higher note. I'm making the string snap back into place faster than it did before. Okay? The inertia, these are thin strings, high notes, these are thick strings, low notes. Okay? This thing here, it's heavier, it's going to move up and down more slowly, so we don't get as quick an oscillation. This is going to give you lower frequencies than this is. So when you want to change your pitch on a guitar, you can switch to a string that has a different density. You can tighten or loosen the string, or you can change the length. You can change the length and thereby reduce the inertia. So the table I gave you there is what these different factors are for every different kind of thing. So every different kind of instrument, string instruments, wind instruments, percussion instruments. These ideas many times involve this wave going back and forth. Not all things do, but most things involve, most oscillations that we use in music involve waves traveling in something or other. So sometimes what we're doing is changing the wave velocity, like I did up here at the front with the spring, where you're tightening the restoring force, that makes the wave velocity higher, so now it can move back and forth through that distance more quickly. Sometimes there's something else involved in it. But the different factors that we're always working with, as I said there, are these different things. So if you look at string instruments, it's how tight is the string. It's how dense is the string, but also how long is it. So the tightness and the density determine what the wave velocity is, and then the length is just going to say, okay, now you've got the velocity. Here's velocity, here's the distance. How much time is it going to take to go back and forth? And the longer it is, the more time it's going to take, the lower the frequency is. Okay? Whereas with something like a flute or a trumpet or actually any wind instrument at all, again, something that you can only actually appreciate if you get into the physics lab and measure it, if I take this tube here and I get a sound wave going back and forth in it, I can drag a microphone down the length of the tube. Did you do that last week in lab, I think? Yeah. So last week in lab, students were setting up oscillations where they would get this tone, put a speaker at the end here, get that particular tone going, and then they drag a microphone down the length of the tube. What they find is that there is no registering of the microphone here, no registering of it here. Those are pressure nodes. Those are places where the pressure is just kept at atmospheric pressure here. Because the way I say it, there's this little tube of air and there's this big room. The room wins here, you know. The room says this is what the pressure is, and then so there's a pressure node there, exactly like there's a displacement node of the string here at the two ends here. Curiously enough, actually this is sort of an odd thing, that if you close up a tube like this, it actually changes the conditions so that what's going on there is actually an antinode, is a maximum of the motion. So instead of thinking about how long does it take the wave to go here and back again, you actually have to think about how long it takes to go here, back, back, and back again. It actually has to take two round trips to do that. And if you don't believe me, I'll show you. What happened to that note?
Got lower.
It got lower by
an octave.
So by covering the end here, I end up getting a tone which is an octave lower, which means it's taking twice as long for the air to complete the cycle it needs to have this reinforced wave. Interestingly enough, this is part of the design of musical instruments. If you have an instrument like a flute that is cylindrical in its shape, it's bore like this, it acts as if the two ends of it are open at both ends. If you take something which is actually conical in its shape, which is a clarinet as an example, you will actually get the end is actually acts like a closed tube. So you actually end up with different frequencies for these different things. One of the curious, and this actually gives you different timbres to the tones that go above that as well. So this is some of the things that we play around with and trying to figure out what the physics of these things are. So as I said, any one of these instruments, whether we're talking about the three I showed you, the string instrument, the flute-like instrument, or the bar-like instrument. So for the bar instrument, It would be the stiffness of the material. How hard is it to bend this steel bar? If I made this thing out of aluminum, exactly the same size, it would actually give me lower notes because the aluminum is actually easier to bend. The restoring force is not as high. So that's a more flexible material, and it is not going to give me exactly the same pitches. But one of the things you can do is you can try to figure out, okay, I want to make an instrument out of these things. How long should I cut them? That's where you actually have to resort to carefully measuring all sorts of things. So if you flip over onto the back side for the, you know, the shock value of, yes, you are in a physics lecture. These are data actually taken from different labs that I did with my students. So the first one is a guitar string. And you notice that for all these, I'm graphing the period versus a size parameter. It's length for the first two, and as I'll explain in a minute, it's volume for the third. So what you see there in all three cases is that the larger the thing gets, the farther you get along the axis this way, the higher the periods are, the longer the oscillations take. And we're trying to actually experimentally just look at them. The first one you see is the kind of data that only show up in physics labs, you know, where the line goes right through all of the points. And that's telling you that these things are actually proportional to each other. If I double the length, I double the period. That means I cut the frequency in half. That means I'm an octave lower than I was. So the notes there are going from E4, the bottom note there, on up to E5. So those are, that's one complete octave of the notes of the C scale between E and E, actually. And you see how they're spaced out there. And we get that, okay, if I want to get a tone, if I want to get one of the Pythagorean tones that is three halves of the frequency of the previous one, I just have to make the string two-thirds as long. Very easy calculation to do. The next one is these guys here, these xylophone bars. So it actually applies to any kind of percussion instrument pretty much. I take these two. The primary note of these, the fundamental, is an octave apart, but you notice that these are not a 2-to-1 ratio of sizes. Okay? In fact, the ratio of these sizes is very similar. It's the same as the ratio of the sizes of these pipes that I had to cut. But that's something you actually have to experimentally investigate. And so we did that in lab. We had people measure the frequencies of different of these pipes, and I plotted out some of them. I actually have 20 pipes like this, but I just didn't want data clutter there. Okay? And no, they don't follow a straight line, but that is not an unfamiliar curve. It's a parabola. And parabola, you may remember in the deep recesses of your algebra minds, is a square relationship. So what this is suggesting is that it's actually, the period is actually proportional to the square of the length. Or another way to say it is, it's the square root of the period that's proportional to the length. So we can actually get the square root relationship there. And I actually pointed that out by bold-facing a couple of these numbers. So you look at the top set here, you notice that in the case, the top one versus the bottom one, when I made the thing twice as long, going from 32.5 to 65, I also doubled the period from 1.52 to 3.04. There's no quiz at the end of this class, don't worry. Okay? Whereas the next one, if I actually change the length by that factor of 2, going from 24 centimeters to 48 centimeters, then the period actually goes up by a factor of 4. That's squaring 2. So increasing the length actually gives you a square relationship. In other words, if I were to take this pipe and cut it in half, it would give me something that was 4 times the original frequency. It would be 2 octaves above where I start, not 1. Okay? That's something you can only figure out if you go into the lab and actually make the measurements. Okay? The third case that I give there is an interesting one. No, I didn't. This was from our dinner last night. So, something we've all done. Blow in a wine bottle, or you put some water in it, and the water goes up to where the marker is there. So there's actually this much air above the water and below the neck. There's this much air below the water above the neck in this one. Okay. So what we see there is, in order to get an octave higher in this case, I actually had to reduce the volume by a lot more than just a factor of two. It's not as if I filled the bottle to halfway here, I would not get that note. So again, this is a lab you still have coming, you'll be happy to know. So what I do for this lab, they're all sitting there with wine bottles, I've got a microphone taped on there. One student is doing this as they pour out more and more water. The other ones are frantically looking at the oscilloscope to figure out what the frequency is from that and convert that to period. And if they did a graph of that, they would see this curve here. Okay? Again, that's not an unfamiliar curve to a physicist. It's just a parabola. But if the parabola turned on its side, which means instead of one thing being the square of the other, it's the other being the square of the first. So it's the same sort of relationship. It's just reversed there. So in this case, if I wanted to double the period from 3.4 to 6.8, I actually have to quadruple the empty volume in the wine bottle. Okay? All these things are things that I obviously chose because the physics theory works out really nicely for this. I'm always very upfront with my students saying, physicists, you ask them why anything is happening the way it does, we will always answer, first of all. You know, whether it's why they call it wiretapping, you know, we always think we have an answer. And our answers are usually about 90% of the story. By that I don't mean we're lying or that we're making stuff up. What I mean is I can explain why you should cut this pipe to be exactly half of this, but then if you actually do it, you find out that's not exactly right. But physicists, looking at it very carefully, figured out why it isn't exactly right, how they have to slightly improve their theory. Now, it's easy enough for me to talk about these pipes here and say how the length of these is determined, the length of these determines what their pitch is. It's a little harder for me to do it with this. A little harder for me to do it with this because I'm not exactly sure how to take into account this part here. But, you know, by carefully making measurements and so on, we can actually figure out within our understanding of it, this is how we do the different things that we do. So we actually come up with fairly good explanations of what happens, and starting from data and then working forward with mathematical models and physical models of what's going on in the system, we actually come up with a fairly consistent view of how to explain all the effects of various musical instruments. But there's a lot of stuff that's really hard to calculate, so that's largely figured out by, not trial and error, but guided trial and error, we'll say. You know, why is the bell of the various horns the shape they are? Well, that was done partly by design, partly by trying different things. Why is it? There we go. Okay. Now we got a flute like this. What's happening there is I'm blowing in here, setting up a standing wave, going back and forth there. This point here is at atmospheric pressure, so there's a node there. That length determines what the pitch is. That's why if I switch to a shorter tube, a shorter tube gives me a higher pitch. But also we know that if I start lifting fingers, qualitative we know, and even semi-quantitative, we know what's going on. If I open up these holes, now the air pressure can be atmospheric pressure somewhere close to this hole. It isn't exactly at this hole. You actually have to play around with it a bit to figure out where the pressure is equilibrating. But the basic idea is there, and then that tells people, okay, what you want to do is drill the holes in these places, and it turns out you're off by a millimeter from where you want. And some of it's easy, you know. I lift my finger, which is right at the middle of the whole pipe, and guess what happens? I get an octave higher, because now the wave is actually only this long. It's half as long as it was before. But then if I ask you, okay, well, what happens if I randomly lift these fingers? I get a note. How
how I would calculate exactly where that node is, I'd be a little lost to do, but we can experimentally make measurements about it. And you even notice other interesting things, like if you look on these flutes, you notice that some holes are bigger than others. That's because, sorry. As I gradually move my finger on and off the hole, a bigger hole allows the node to come in farther, a smaller hole, it doesn't get as far. So we explore these things experimentally, trying to figure out what these relations are. And this is just one of the ways that I try to show students in the class that actually mathematically and physically engaging with a systematic study of something, it doesn't remove the mystery or the beauty of it. It actually gives you ideas of, okay, this is why it's happening, and maybe even this is how I can control it to be something different. You can imagine, many of you who I'm sure enjoyed the exhibitions here yesterday and can experience more of them today, you can imagine the artistic possibilities that would come into the student's mind if they start to understand the physical principles behind what they're trying to show, what they're trying to do. And so just as we try to teach students the use of language and the use of argumentation to advance their ideas, I'm trying to teach them how science and math can also help them advance whatever it is they're trying to do. So I'm happy to answer any questions about anything or to give more demonstrations. Yes?
This question will belie the fact that I didn't study physics a whole lot.
Good.
I understand when a string is held in two spots, how it stops. But the fact that a column of wind or vibration is stopped by atmospheric pressure, why does that happen?
Okay, it's not that it's stopped by atmospheric pressure. What's happening is there's this compression wave traveling down. And, you know, bear in mind that I teach this every year and I tell students at the beginning, this is one of the most counterintuitive things I'm going to talk about all year, is why it is that an opening, it's easy to see with the string. You know, it hits there, it yanks on it, it gets pulled back the other way. Okay? So what I would ask you instead is to think about what kind of wave we're talking about. So the waves and the springs are what we call transverse waves. If the wave is traveling this way, the oscillation is actually perpendicular to it, where a sound is a longitudinal wave. It's a compression wave along this direction. Okay? So we imagine what's happening as this compression travels down here. Now, what's going to happen if it hits a solid wall? It's clearly going to be whacked into that and be pushed back. So it's going to have a hard reflection off of this, right? Because the wall is exerting a big force on that. Whereas when it gets to the end of the opening of a tube, the air can just filter on out. There's nothing making it turn around. So that means the force on the air at that point is zero. It's not that the motion is zero, it's that the force on it is zero. And what microphones pick up is pressure variation. So if I managed to construct this room so that there was wave interference going on, and this point right here was a dead spot, with, you know, the sounds canceling out right there, that means if you put a microphone there, it's not going to register anything because there's no variation in the pressure. That's what's happening at the end of the tube. It's that as this wave travels back and forth down here, when it gets to here, the pressure of the wave there is going to be determined by the atmospheric pressure out here, and it's just never going to vary. So in order to make that happen, it actually ends up reflecting a wave back this way. So it's very similar to...
Energy has to go somewhere?
Right, the energy has to go somewhere, and some of it gets out, obviously, because we hear it. But most of the energy goes back the other way. Jonathan's going to chime in with something.
No, it's a different question.
Sure.
So I'm in another project studying instruments, right? Uh-huh. And one thing that instrument makers and buyers argue a lot about is materials.
Right.
So as a physicist, do you think that there are factors other than plasticity and density and shape that affect the sound of an instrument? Or to put it another way, does the species of the wood that guitar is made out of matter in any way other than just purely as a set of physical factors?
Well, the physical factors I would think of, you actually listed. So you're talking about plasticity and porousness and so on. So what else? What other kinds of factors?
Well, I don't know. Like, it's a whole, there's a huge debate. About,
right.
Like, so among guitar makers, for instance, there's a lot of talk about woods.
Right.
Is wood species a good stand-in for tonal differences among guitars?
Well,
or is type of metal a good, or plastic,
right,
stand-in
so,
for,
you know,
tonal qualities of flutes?
When, you know, my one of my sisters is a music teacher, and we all played, all eight of us played in band growing up, so the house was cacophony usually. But I remember when she was in college, and my father got this $3,000 bill for a gold flute, and he was wondering why, and Mary Jo said, well, you know, I just the sound is so much better, and he was pulling his hair out, because of course, he couldn't hear any difference between. So the idea of materials, you know, everything I've said should say that you would get the same sort of sound out of making a flute out of this as you would out of the metal that it's usually made out of. And I think there are differences there. Now, there aren't differences in terms of what the primary standing wave is that gets set up there, but that's not the only wave that happens. Just as, you can stay seated, that's fine. So just as this is one wave that can happen, this wave can also happen. This wave can happen. All these are different standing waves. There are actually an infinite number of them. And which ones of those get accentuated or reinforced is going to be determined partly by the flexibility and the absorptivity of the different materials that are around it. So I think the way that the different woods in string instruments, the varnishes that people use, the shapes that the particular filigrees or sizes of the F-holes and all these things, they all have a lot to do with how the different overtones are going to be emphasized, and in particular, how they're going to be radiated. So the flexibility of the walls is not just going to determine what sound is sitting right here, but what sound gets emanated out and in what directions in the room. Because if most of the sound is coming out here, but not all of it, some of it is coming out of the flexing of the material, which is certainly the case with a string instrument. The string itself is hardly doing anything, but it's making all the wood vibrate, and how flexible that wood is and how it's responding to those frequencies is going to make a lot of difference in what kinds of sounds get emitted. Yeah.
So I think you started to talk about what I wanted to ask you, which is how do you teach timbre and what sort of experiments
okay.
do
so,
you have to think about timbre?
So the two things I talked about, because they're the easiest ones to talk about physically, are pitch, which mostly corresponds to frequency, not entirely, but mostly, and loudness, which mostly corresponds to physical amplitude or intensity, but again, not entirely. And it's one of my favorite things to read aloud in class is the Acoustic Society of America's definition of timbre, where it says, timbre is every aspect of a sound other than its pitch and intensity. it's the miscellaneous category of definitions. So what I talk about there is I try to articulate many of the aspects that contribute to timbre. From the physicist's point of view, one of the primary one is what is the mixture of these overtones. So the difference between a flute playing a particular note and a trumpet playing exactly the same note is they're both producing the same set of overtones but in different ratios. So the very earliest synthesizers would just take oscillators which were tuned to all the overtones, and they said, okay, a flute has this pattern, a trumpet has this pattern, and they just dial them in on the computer, and when you press down the key, that's what would come out, and it sounded horrible. What that's telling you is that, okay, that's a starting point, but that's not the whole thing. So what else goes into timbre? Modulation goes into timbre, the idea that we're not keeping the same tones all the time. Attack and decay go into timbre. One of the things which tends to blow my students' minds a little bit is after we've been doing all this talk about pitch and frequency, sound is pitch, sound is frequency, pitch and loudness, pitch and loudness, thinking that these are two primary things, I say, okay, well, what note is this? They say what it is, and I say, what note is this? E. Say it's the same note. I said, but it wasn't the same sound. Why not?
And that's because the overtone frequencies actually are what determine the different vowel sounds we have. We learn to associate particular combinations of vowel sounds with, particular overtones with the vowel sounds of our languages. And more than that, it's much more complicated because you recognize A as the same vowel sound, even though none of the frequencies were the same. So it's not just, okay, it's always these frequencies that are in this sound. It's some particular complicated relationship between them. So we talk about modulation. We talk about attack and decay. We talk about these frequency overtone mixtures. I talk about nonlinearities, the fact that most systems, physicists are starting to study more and more systems which don't simply add up things and give you the sum, but you start to get difference frequencies and interference frequencies between them. So the fact that any real material has some nonlinearities built into it means that not all the overtones are going to be the simple overtones that we have. Even taking something like this, the reason that we spend most of our time in the acoustics course I teach studying strings and tubes is because those are the only totally linear systems. Everything else, the relationships are squares or square roots, which means when you go to the overtones of this, the overtones of this are twice the frequency, three times, four times, five times, very simple. The overtones of this are various squares of pi, you know, not very conducive to, oh, it's the simple Pythagorean harmony. Anybody who knows the history of Pythagoras knows that having anything that involved an irrational number could get you in trouble with Pythagoras. So things that involve square roots of pi would especially be problematic. So what we're saying is that something like this, it gives you different overtones which are not even harmonics of each other. Even that simple fact of closing the tube or opening the tube changes what the overtone pattern is. And one of them has a full bunch of octave harmonies in it, the other one has no octave harmonies in it. That gives one of them a much more open sound than the other, but also a less rich sound than the other. So these different aspects of timbre, the physicist can help you identify the variables to look at, but we make no claim of aesthetic judgment or comparative importance of them. We say, look, we've got all these different things going on, and this is what you should look for when you're trying to hear that. And we've shown you some ways of how to measure those aspects, but we understand that whatever list we come up with is going to be incomplete. I imagine people want to get some lunch break in, so I thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you.
And please, if you have any need of any of the stuff I do, you know how to get in touch with me here at Bard. So I'm always happy to be in communication or send people out resources if they want them.